Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hey, gang. Today's guest is Derek Sanders, lead vocalist for the Tallahassee, Florida rock band Mayday Parade. Derek and I take a deep dive into their fan favorite hit Kids in Love from their 2009 album Anywhere But Here. We talk about the pros and cons of working with outside songwriters, and when embraced with an open mind, can many times yield positive results, as evidenced by Kids in Love. Derek shares that his very first demo of the song was built around a piano part that only happens once in the bridge. He also tells an interesting story behind his love interest, whom the song is centered around, and how her parents at the time weren't so fond of Derek. I'm happy to report that all turned out well for him, though. How well, you ask? You're just going to have to listen to the episode to find out. For all this and much more, grab a bag of Cheetos, a bowl of marshmallows, and let's party.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard?
You're right up the road from Gainesville, Florida, where Less Than Jake cut our teeth and still reside. And you're up there in Tallahassee. How's things going in the state's capital?
Things are going well, man. Tallahassee is, I'm sure it's a lot like, you know, it is a lot like Gainesville, and but it's a growing city. It's expanding rapidly, and some people think that's like weird, but I think it's kind of cool, you know, and there's a lot of like new things coming in, and I think it's cool to be in a place that is doing that as opposed to somewhere that's like, you know, stagnant or you know, I don't know. It's just, there's a lot of life in this city, and I've lived my whole life here. I'm the only one in the band who still lives here. Everybody has kind of scattered out there.
So the band formed in 2005.
That's right.
Which, you know, and I've said this on the episode before, and this is showing my age, not yours. I'll always look at you guys as kids, you know, because you were like, hey, there's a new band on the Warped Tour. There's these kids, Mayday Parade. And you guys aren't kids anymore.
Right. It's crazy. Yeah.
You guys are coming up on 20 years here. It is crazy.
Yeah. It's like, how does this happen? But we're happy to still be doing it.
Absolutely. So the track we're going to talk about today, Kids in Love, this is a really cool song. A lot of production things with this one that really interests me. This song was released as the second single from your album Anywhere But Here, which came out in 2009. And the single was released on May 18th, 2010. So set this one up for us. Where were you at when you started to write this one?
The first memory I have of beginning to write this song was on tour in 2008. I was actually thinking about this earlier today, trying to kind of, you know, rehash some of how this went down. And we were on tour with All Time Low and The Main and Every Avenue. One of my favorite tours that we've ever done in the history of this band. It was just so much fun. And it was really, you know, it was in the early days of things really just kind of first starting to pick up for us, and everything was just so exciting. And we were at the Cleveland House of Blues, and I was in our green room there and had my keyboard just out, set up to write and jam on or whatever. And the first thing I wrote was, cause it was kind of like a in the bridge was like a keyboard or like a piano kind of lick thing that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the first thing I wrote, and then kind of started messing around with the rest of it from there. And we co-wrote the song. We ended up doing a lot of co-writes for that album, for Anywhere But Here. We had done our first album on Fearless, which is an independent label, and then we were upstream to Atlantic Records, and I'm sure you know is a whole different ball game, and being on a major label, and it was actually kind of a really weird experience for us. And throughout the years, we've kind of like come to peace with some of it. But for a long time, we had these bitter feelings about this record.
Well, let me stop you there. And I know exactly what you mean, and you shouldn't feel bitter. More bands co-write than people think do.
Right. Oh, for sure.
It's like a hidden secret that a lot of bands can't admit. There's nothing wrong with it. I've co-written before. I love it.
Right.
Because for me, it pushes me as a songwriter, because I already know the trick I'm going to go to in the bridge. I've done it in 100 songs. It's familiar. And I've talked about that on the show. There's nothing wrong with co-writing. I mean, your first record came out 2007. It was a Lesson in Romantics. And then, as you said, you got upstreamed to Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And, they probably wanted you to do some co-writes. What I researched here was a gentleman named Greg Wattenberg. Is that who you wrote with?
That's correct. Yeah, so it was basically, being on Atlantic, and they wanted us to work with these different guys. And so myself and Jake, our drummer, went around. We did a handful. We went to Nashville. We went to California. We went to New York City and worked with a couple guys. And Greg was one of those guys. He's a great guy, great songwriter. It was fun. Like, the whole thing was fun. It just, like, I don't know. I agree with you. There's absolutely nothing wrong with co-writing, but I feel like it just wasn't a process that I really enjoyed. But I think part of that was also the idea of just like being put in a room with this random person that you don't know anything about. He doesn't really know anything about your band. And it's tough. And one thing that kind of bothered me about it was that I felt like, especially, and I'm sorry if I'm, being negative right off the bat.
Oh, no, bring the negativity. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I'm just, let's be honest about it. Yeah, but
no, this is interesting. Let's hear it.
Yeah. Well, I felt like with so much of what happened with the co-writing for this record was, for me, I'm like, usually I finish lyrics last, usually I have kind of, song structure and melodies, and then the lyrics kind of finish last. And so I have a lot of these ideas that were basically done songs, just they weren't finished lyrically. And that was kind of the case with this one, with Kids in Love, is that I had sort of a fully, idea of a song, but we didn't have all the lyrics done yet. And so that's basically what we did, was just sort of co-write the lyrics. And then it's tough to, sit in a room and go, well, all right, we got to write the lyrics to this song. And if it's not really moving anywhere, or if you're not really vibing, you eventually just kind of go, all right, whatever, that's good enough. Just keep going. You kind of feel like you're sort of settling a little bit and just sort of kind of cramming to make it happen. And then it's kind of a pain later if you decide, well, I actually don't really like some of those lyrics. I want to go back and change them. Then you get this pushback from the guys going, no, wait a second. They're, I don't know, just the whole thing was so strange. And
well, it sounds like it was just disruptive to your songwriting process, which, as a younger songwriter, you were younger back then, that had to be jarring. I completely understand it from that standpoint.
Right, for sure. Yeah, it was something that we weren't used to, and we're just kind of trying to figure out as we went. And I mean, it was definitely a cool experience, and I'm grateful. And one thing that I've, with all of this kind of weird, feelings we have with that album, I'm glad that we did it. I'm glad that we went through it, and we learned so much from making that album, because I feel like we didn't really know. There were six members of the band for the first record, and then one guy left, and there were five of us moving forward. And we had gained, a decent bit of success, and we didn't really have like solid footing of like, okay, this is who we are as a band. This is what we want. We were kind of lost and just trying to like figure out what to do. And then making this album, I feel like kind of gave us that clarity of like, okay, wait a second, we need to pause and like look at this and like, what are we really trying to do? And, who do we want to be as a band? And we had a much clearer picture of that moving forward. And it's a process that like destroys so many bands. I feel like there's so many bands that do that, major label attempt record, they try to push it radio and do all that, and if things don't work out super well with it, then a lot of times that's the end of a band's career. And so to like have gone through that whole machine and then still like I feel like we kind of came out even stronger out of it is a blessing, really.
I think the proof is when I was researching the song, and I've seen you guys play this song live, is, you know, when there's 10,000 kids at Warped Tour screaming every lyric back to you, I think it worked.
Right, for sure. And that's, yeah. You're right, ultimately that's the, and we, so we
that's
did.
That's the gauge.
Right, and we did the 10 year of that was, I guess, now 2 years ago, 2019, we did a short run of shows playing that full album, and that's a big part of what made us all go, like, you know, like these people, you know, you sold out shows of people singing every word to these songs. Is like, you can't really be like mad about that or bummed about that, that there were some things that were weird. Like, it's a great thing, and so we all, you know, feel a lot better about it. But,
well, and believe it or not, you know, I'm sure that you learned a lot through the process. I know that I always did. Even there was some sessions I went in begrudgingly. I didn't want to do it, and it just,
right,
at the end of the day, it made me a better songwriter. I hadn't heard of Greg Wattenberg. Some of his credits include writing for Philip Phillips, Train, Daughtry, and Goo Goo Dolls. So he's done some big stuff. So I was interested to see his name, as well as David Bendith, because this guy is just done so much, and I'm consider myself a musicologist, I guess, and I just hadn't ran across him. How did David get brought in? Was that something from Atlantic, or was he a choice of the band?
Right, it was mostly Atlantic, and I feel like there were a couple guys that they pitched, and this was, I don't know how long, maybe like a year after Riot had come out, Paramore's album Riot,
yes,
which obviously is just such a phenomenal album and sounds amazing. And so that was a big part of it for us, was like, well, this guy did that record. Like, this is, you know, this is kind of a, should be great. And it was really, it was interesting, man. He's, I don't know what to really, there's definitely, you know, there were some of those like negative feelings we had about some of the things, the way that he handled things, and feeling like he was more on the label's side than our side, you know what I mean? But ultimately, he's a really great guy, and he's super talented. He's definitely like kind of crazy, and has some, I don't know, he's a very bizarre guy.
Most producers are.
Right. And a lot of the best ones are, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they're like creative geniuses. No, and yeah, I had heard his name through Paramore. He's also done Breaking Benjamin, Papa Roach, Taken Back Sunday, A Day to Remember. And, you know, looking at his age now, when he did your record, he was in his early 50s. I mean, that's a little bit on the older spectrum, working with super young bands. So I was,
right,
I was kind of impressed by that. So do you remember in the process of writing for the record when Kids in Love was written?
That was one of the first ideas. Now it was a pretty lengthy process of, cause you know, we put out A Lesson in Harmonics in 2007. And then I feel like for the next like year and a half or 2 years, we were like building material. We wrote so many songs, man. I feel like we wrote over 30, maybe close to 40 songs for this album. And Kids in Love was definitely one of the first ideas. And then again, it took a while for it to be finished. And most of that was the lyrics. But then eventually I'd done a demo of it. And gosh, it's so hard to remember all this. It must have been that I'd made a demo of it, but there, you know, the second verse didn't have lyrics or whatever it was, and the label felt strong about the song but wanted us to go in with Greg to just kind of see what would happen there.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So how, you know, if you can remember, how much of the song as it is now was it then when you started working with Greg? What was brought into him demo wise?
It was pretty similar. I mean, I guess I haven't listened to that demo in so long, but I think it was mostly there. We didn't really change a lot, and it was mostly just finishing up the lyrics. And then when we got in with David did kind of this weird thing where like every single song on that record, when we were in pre-pro, he'd go like, this bridge, I don't know about this bridge. We gotta start over on this bridge. And so we'd like rewrite the bridge to like every single song on the record. And that was the case with this one as well. I don't even remember now what the original bridge was.
That's interesting. You mentioned the bridge, because we'll get to that later, because this is an odd bridge in,
right,
this song.
Yeah.
In a very cool way, though. I really like it. So what did he, you said when David first heard the song, though, that he liked it?
Yeah, for sure. Because he was a part of the process. I forget for how long, but for definitely months out from us going in with him, we'd send him these demos and we'd talk on the phone with him, and he would tell us, you know, which songs he felt strong about and which ones he didn't. And this was one that he was into early on, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, the song is 3 minutes and 36 seconds. There's a 14-second intro. It's like a drum intro with just this single guitar, and the drums just sound absolutely huge.
Yeah.
They sound awesome. It's such a great intro. And then you're into verse one, which is kind of split into two parts. And I'll go with the first part here, and then I'll have you set it up. I look back to the one and only summertime, and my girl was the envy of every friend of mine. She slept safely in my arms. We were so young and invincible. And the drums here, I wrote in my notes, are a variation of the intro. There's no hi-hat, so it's not a full drum beat yet.
I look back to the one and only summertime when my girl was the envy of every friend of mine. She slept safely in my arms.
Set up this first verse for us.
Well, you know, the whole song is kind of, and it's funny now thinking back on it, because I was like 21 or maybe like 22 throughout the process of writing the song. But it was like looking back at being like 15, 16 years old. And it's kind of, you know, I guess it's sort of like loosely about, it's actually my wife, Lauren. We weren't together at this point, but we had, when we were in high school, but when I was 16 and she was 15, we dated and then, you know, broke up. And then for many, many years, we were just really good friends. And then now, of course, we're married. But there was a summer where she spent a lot of time down in Tampa, in Clearwater, with her sister. And it's kind of a long, complicated story, but we, her parents weren't very like stoked on us seeing each other. And
they didn't like the long haired guy in a band. What?
Right. And so I would, I'd like go down there. I'd get like, you know, one of my friends to drive me down there, and we'd spend a couple of days down in Clearwater, and we'd like secretly hang out. and then I'd come back up to Tallahassee. And so that's kind of the song is mostly kind of about that, but it's also kind of loose. Like with a lot of songs, when they're about a particular thing for me, I don't like, it's not always so like literal, I guess, you know what I mean? It's just kind of like loosely about kind of an idea. But yeah, it was mostly just kind of that summer of being, I guess I would have been 16 or 17 years old and going down to Clearwater to secretly hang out with my girlfriend. Yeah.
That's awesome. So do you remember if the first verse were these just your lyrics, or was this something that Greg and you worked on? And I can kind of see from a song like this that's so personal, it's about your love interest that, you know, that is now your wife, to have someone come in and be, you know, and be like, well, how do you know what I'm thinking? This is my song, you know? And so from that standpoint, I completely get it. But do you remember if Greg had a hand in these lyrics, or was this all you at this point?
Right. You know, it's hard to say. I think, if I remember correctly, that the first verse was there. And maybe we tweaked a couple things, you know, maybe we changed a few lines that were there. I mean, the second verse is where I feel like where I don't think I had anything, and where he really, and Jake, our drummer, was there as well. And he was throwing out, ideas. And, so I'm pretty sure that first verse there was mostly just kind of what I came up with. Yeah.
Well, we get into the, what I'm saying is the second half of the first verse. We're still the verse here. Mm-hmm. The drums are fully in. The hi-hat comes in. There's a single note guitar doing this really cool counter melody. It's predominantly, I'm hearing in the left speaker, really neat little thing that happens there. I really love it.
Close lips, she was never one to kiss and tell. Those trips in the summer never went so well. Young love is such dumb love.
The lyric is closed lips. She was never one to kiss and tell, which this is a side note here. She couldn't because her parents didn't like you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
those trips in the summer never went so well. Young love was such dumb love. Call it what you want. It was still enough.
Right. Yeah, gosh, it's funny. Like, I sing this song all the time, you know, and it's like I never think about it, you know. You know what I mean? Like, if you're like on autopilot. But yeah, I like a lot. I love the young love is such dumb love, call it what you want. It was still enough, I think is, is a strong line. And I remember Greg being stoked on that one. I think that maybe we tweaked that one a little bit while we were there. But yeah.
Well, the song is building, and then we get into the next part. And you know, when I first sat down to really analyze this, this is one of the most amazing pre-choruses, because this sounds like you've reached the chorus to me.
Nice.
This is a chorus.
Right.
As far, you know, it's like you almost get a double chorus in this song, because it's so damn catchy. This is the first time that a backing vocal comes in the song. You got the high harmony that comes in here. And there's a really cool, I'm calling it the noodly guitar part, again, kind of off in the left speaker that is moving things along. But this part just really lifts. It doesn't sound like a pre-chorus. It sounds like a chorus. The lyric is, "And you're still out of my reach, and you're still all of the things that I want in my life. How could I ask you to leave me?"
Well, I mean, clearly, I still had feelings for Lauren, you know, not currently my wife. You know, it was like one of those things where, like I said, like we were always close. Even after we broke up, we were like close to like best friends, you know, for years and years. And she's always been someone who's really important in my life since I met her. And clearly, that kind of shows here, you know.
When you tracked the song in 09, were you guys together, and did she know it was about her?
We were not together.
You weren't.
No, yeah. And she found out later, and I think she's like, "No, it's not." She's like, when I was like, "The song, you know, is about you and going down," she's like, no, it's not. You're making that up." And I'm like, "Well, no,
I'm
not."
Yeah. How's your relationship with the in-laws these days?
It's actually really good. Her parents are awesome. And
I had to ask, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's for sure. Yeah, no, they're great. You know, it's like...
That's cool.
She was 15. It's like such a, you know, I can understand some of their, you know, resentment towards me at the time, you know.
We're musicians. Yeah, of course you can understand it.
Right.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
We get into the first chorus, and I wrote my notes here. The kitchen sink is in, the big guitars, the octave guitars, the vocal harmonies. And again, it just, from that pre-chorus, it even gets catchier now that we're in the chorus. And we were just kids in love. I feel like I said it before, we're getting a double chorus here. The lyric is, "And we were just kids in love. The summer was full of mistakes we wouldn't learn from. The first kiss stole the breath from my lips. Why did the last one tear us apart?"
Right.
And before we go into that real quick, up to this point, Derek, do you recall if the song changed at all arrangement-wise, or was this pretty much what your idea was? You know, I know maybe not lyrically, but melody-wise and chord arrangement and structure.
Yeah, it was pretty much the same, other than the intro, the drum guitar thing. Was ad-lib. It started just with the guitar, and "I look back to the one and only son," like it just came straight in with, and no,
oh, okay.
It was no drums, just the guitar and vocal. And then in that sort of second half of that first verse you were talking about was when the drums first kicked in. But other than that, yeah, it was that first verse into the chorus. The only thing that we changed in the chorus with David Bendith was the last line of the chorus. And this is one that I actually like, I still kind of wish we hadn't changed. The original lyric was, I think it's, "We didn't even care at all." It was "The first kiss stole the breath from my lip, and we didn't even care." Oh shit, I don't even remember what it was, but
what, you don't sit around and listen to your demos like I do all day?
Yeah, I probably will after this. I gotta go back and and find it. But it was one that we changed. It was like David felt strong about that we needed to change. And in the long run, I kind of wonder if it would have been stronger the way it was. But, you know, I don't know, whatever. That doesn't matter now.
That's interesting. And not to be argumentative, I really love that last line. I think that's cool. But I never knew there was anything else there either.
For sure. Right, exactly. Yeah.
What did you take from that line? What, I guess, was that something that David or Greg came up with? Why did the last one tear us apart? What was it about that didn't... Because, I mean, you guys did break up.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was like... I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, I wrote that. It was kind of like... when David would, because there were a handful of songs again that were like this, where he'd be like, the last line of the chorus is just not there yet, and so I'd just kind of throw him options, you know, like what about this, and then, you know, the next day, like, what about this or this, you know, and just kind of throw things out, and I threw that one out, and he was into it, and I guess, I don't know, I just, it's such a weird thing, you know, it's also, like, been in your head for such a long time, because, like I said, this song was probably written, you know, maybe first or close to the beginning out of all these songs. I'd been hearing it one way for like a year, and then changing that is always kind of like jarring, you know, and it takes a while to settle in and get used to. And you're probably right. It probably is better the way it is. And that's part of a producer's job, I guess, is to have that kind of outside perspective. And
well, we as artists, we get stuck with what I call as demoitis,
right?
You know, you just live with something for so long. I can't tell you how many times I was convinced with something I wrote, this is the greatest thing in the world, and I'm sat on it for 3 months, the band hears it, and the first thing they tear apart is the line that I love the most about it. I'm like, what?
Right.
And you know, usually it'll get changed, and I'll look back some years later and be like, yeah, they were right.
Right. Well, you're right. It is most of the time that is the case, where you go, okay, now it just takes that separation, you know, and
you become so attached to it. It's hard to not be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a tricky thing. Yeah. We deal with that. Of course, we actually just about 2 weeks ago got back home from being in the studio. We just finished recording our 7th full length album. And
congratulations.
And yeah, thank you. And so definitely dealing with a lot of that throughout the whole process. It's still the case. It still happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Those wonderful arguments we have in the studio, aren't they great?
Yeah.
So we get out of the chorus after that line, when did the last one tear us apart? And there's like a half measure. There's a drum reintro that sets up for verse two.
Mm-hmm.
And the first half, again, I split it into two parts here. We'll go for the first half. Our breath smelled of cigarettes and alcohol. We'd walk down the beach counting every star. Our hearts beat inside our chest, leaving us gasping for every breath. There's a lot of imagery there.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if I'm just being completely honest, this is where it gets a little, you know, I don't know. I don't want to, you know, it's a little cheesy, a little like, well, this is like this is where we really, like, these are the lyrics that we wrote, the three of us in the room at the time, that we didn't spend, like, necessarily, you know, maybe a couple hours on or whatever it was. And I remember the cigarettes and alcohol thing was like is that weird? Should we not do that? Oh, in fact, and sorry, this is getting too sidetracked, but Atlantic had us record a separate version of this, that first line. Just in case, because they were going to push this song to radio, and they were like, in case there's any, like, you know, like Disney or whatever, kind of like more like kid-friendly spots that we can get, we want you to sing. And I can't even remember what... So we came up with an alternate line for that first line, sang that, and then I just never heard that again, you know, for the rest of my life.
Was it Cheetos and marshmallows?
Right. It had to, you know, I think it was like the cringiest thing ever. But it exists somewhere, that version of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to knock on it or whatever, but there's some lyrics that even like when you sing live, you kind of can't help but like cringe a little. And, you know, I guess these are a little bit of that, but it's all good. Yeah.
Well, no, I appreciate your honesty, and I completely relate to that. There are lyrics that I look back and when I wrote when I was 18 that I still sing, and
right.
But the fans love it. I always go back to that.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
They're screaming it back at you, and it kind of validates it. The second part, this is where it gets interesting, because the second half of the second verse It isn't like the second half of the first verse. Mm-hmm. It changes here.
Right.
Whose idea was that? The melody changes. I'll get into the lyric in a second, but it's structurally just way different than the first time. Her smile with the wind blowing through her hair was so contagious in the
air. So satisfying. I think that was me, and both with sort of the lyric idea here and right, the melody that kind of is more of an ad lib, kind of a new thing. I try and do that a lot. I feel like where in a second verse, I feel like there's that room to kind of switch things up a little bit. It doesn't have to be like a, you know, copy paste of the first verse, which with new lyrics, you know, I like to, and sometimes maybe it's a bad thing. Sometimes a song needs that repetition and that benefits the song. But I've always, that's one thing I just try and do, I guess, is switch things up.
I must have rewound this part and compared A, beat it to the first half of the first verse probably 10 times, figuring what's different here. I'm like, it's just completely different. Even down to the single note guitar here, it's lower in the mix than it is the first time, which I found that very interesting. Just that's usually, you know, it'll be louder as you get into the song. And
sure,
that was something that was different from a production value.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, there's a lot of things you're pointing out that I hadn't even really thought of, but that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was striking. I'm like, why does this sound different? I went back, wait a second, the guitar's louder the second time in the first verse. The other thing here, you know, and I'll get to the lyric now. Her smile with the wind blowing through her hair was so contagious in the air. And that's really held out, the word air.
Right.
And that's why you don't get a third line here.
Right.
Because the air's held out. Okay. The backing vocals come in here, which the backing vocals do not come in on the first verse at all. And you get the backing vocals on the back half, was so contagious in the air, so satisfying, and I'm still smiling. Do you remember the talk of the backing vocal being there and not in the first verse?
Not really. I remember Jake, our drummer, not liking that line for whatever reason and having to kind of just be like, it's fine, it's good, you know, and having to kind of, you know, work through that. But not really. God, I wish that I, you know, it's been so long, but I don't remember where that idea came from necessarily. But I think it did change a little from what we had first wrote at Greg Wattenberg's. The melody ended up changing for whatever reason slightly. But yeah, and it's one that, like, you know, it's funny because I never even really, I guess, thought of that part as a backing vocal, but it kind of the next part kind of overlaps on top of it.
Yeah.
And so that's one that I like, I can't do live. I just don't sing the first part of the the next pre-chorus. Although we have two other guys in the band that sing. I should have just asked them to, you know, help out there. But yeah, now, like, what, 12 years later, you know, maybe we'll start
now
doing
you
it
now better. You probably will after this. Well,
right.
Damn it. Now we have to do it.
Yeah.
Do you remember David, Bandith producer, having any issues with this being, because it is really different, this second half of this verse compared mm-hmm. to the first one. Was it ever brought up, this is too out there, too different, or it's just, yeah, it's different, it's cool?
Yeah, I don't remember him having any resistance about it. He may have, like I said, there's one kind of melody change that happened, and I think he was part of that, but otherwise it was only, you know, Jake, again, I feel like didn't like this part in general here, but everyone else, I think, thought it was cool. Yeah,
cool. Well, we get into the second pre-chorus, which is again like a chorus, and you're still out of my reach, and you're still all of the things that I want in my life. How could I ask you to leave me? And a lot of little subtle things in this one. For instance, on the second line, still on that word, you do this little vocal hiccup mm-hmm. there that's not the first time. And it's just really, really cool, because it's different enough, but it's still catchy as hell. And on the third line, that I want in my life, you use a different melody on that whole line than you did the first time. Was that conscious on your behalf or David's, or who thought of that?
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm sorry if, you know, I'm taking like credit for all that, but I think that was me, and yeah, definitely the still, the little kind of run thing on the still.
Yeah.
I thought was really cool, and it's like I'm not like great at that kind of stuff, and so I feel like I don't do that live, but I should probably do the little thing, the little run thing. And then you're right, and that different melody there, that's like something that and it's actually something I think I've been trying to not do so much lately. I used to be very much like, make every chorus different, make every pre-chorus different. I wanted it to be clear that like nothing was like just copy and pasted.
And that's why I appreciate this so much, is because it's not copy and pasted. And
right.
for some of our listeners don't know what we're talking about, you know, you'll get a measure in a bridge or in a pre-chorus, and the vocals are exactly the same as the second pre-chorus, and you'll just basically copy and paste it.
Right.
You're not going to have the singer re-sing it again. And the fact that you didn't do that here is refreshing. And it just, I don't know, just gives, it lets the song breathe and give identity to me.
Yeah, that was kind of my mindset at the time. It also kind of feels like it's building a little. It's, you know, it's a little bit higher of a melody than the first pre. But I know that the counter argument to that, that some of the guys in the band, in my band, would make and kind of make sense, is that it's okay sometimes for it to be... just the same, and it kind of gives it more of a sing-along kind of vibe if they hear it the same way each time. Whereas if you're switching things up every time, that can, you know what I mean? That's a little, I guess, confusing. And so,
well, and in this part, I don't think you switched it up enough. I agree with what you just said completely, but I don't think you switched it up too much. It just gives it a little bit of its own, a different flair, because the actual chorus, now we're in chorus two, those are all the same. Those don't
right.
differentiate. And I don't think they needed to be different. I think
sure.
they had to be the chorus. You have to latch on to that. And again, the lyric is, "And we were just kids in love. The summer was full of mistakes we wouldn't learn from. The first kiss stole the breath from my lips. Why did the last one tear us apart?" And now we're into the bridge, which was the first thing that you kind of wrote. This piano part is killer. It is so catchy. I almost feel like, and I've talked about this in the show before, like that thing could have been its own song, and it's
right.
really only in there at the bridge, and then it comes in at the very end of the song, which is more of the guitar riff that's accompanying the piano thing. Was there ever a thought of that? Like, wait a second, this is its own standalone song? Because sometimes I've written riffs that I don't just want to waste on a 7-second bridge part.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, because that was the first thing I wrote, and I remember showing some of the guys, like just that piano, you know, riff thing, and then be like, that's super cool, you know. And I think once I had written that and then started working on the rest of the song, I just felt strong about it all together as one thing. I don't think I ever entertained the idea of taking that bridge or that riff and making it something else. But we did, you know, I'm trying to think now, because as I said, we did change this bridge, but I forget what it, I mean, it had to have been that piano part, and then maybe it's the vocal part that we changed, or I don't know what it was. But yeah, I first wrote it on piano. The first demo that we did, it was just the guitar doing that. And then later on, we decided to bring back because it just sounded so cool on piano, and I'm glad that we did that. Of course, when we play it live, I don't play piano on that part. It's all just guitar. But
yeah,
I'm glad that we you know, went back and put it back on piano, because that's the way it was written, and it just kind of feels so good like that.
And it just really adds a really cool texture. And it, again, it's only 7 seconds long, the piano with a accompanying guitar part, and then we're in the bridge. And this is, like I said, a really interesting bridge, because the band is back in now. The drums are almost hearkening back to the drum intro, almost mimicking the drum pattern there. There's no hi-hat. It's not like a full drum beat. And the lyric is, "We're falling down. Can we pick up the pieces? We're at an all-time low. How do we get it back?" And then the third line is, "We're falling down. Can we pick up the pieces?" Then the fourth line doesn't happen, because out of nowhere, this guitar solo comes for like one measure, and then the fourth line comes. How do we get it back? We're falling down. Can we pick up very strange, right. Very odd, but it works. It works. Yeah. When you get to the part of that third line, that's when the drums go to halftime. There's just a hell of a groove there. And like I said, instead of this going into the fourth line, the guitar solo comes, and then we get the last line, which is, "We're falling down. Can we pick up the pieces now?" Whose idea was that?
Well, this one, again, yeah, this was like, we messed with this bridge a lot with David, and I remember being like, this is kind of weird, this is kind of different, you know, and be like, are you sure this is what you're thinking, you know, and especially, right, so there's, you know, we're falling down through the pieces, we're at an all-time low, how do we get it back? And then I felt like it should just be, we're falling down, and then guitar solo, and not have that extra tag, can we pick up the pieces in there? Because it seems like unnatural the way that cuts off and goes into the solo. But now it's like you said, it works, and it doesn't bother me. But at the time, I remember being like, this is kind of strange, but it's cool. And one thing I'll say real fast is that the all-time low thing was like, I wanted to I thought it was so cool the way the Used in My Chemical Romance were like friends back in the day, and there's the song by the Used where he says something about a chemical romance in the song, you know. I must have got something in the heat of all these dances. I'm a worm with no more chances, and I've lost all doubt in a chemical romance. I guess I've been shit.
I was going to ask you about that line, because I know you have history with All Time Low. Was that direct reference to them?
Yeah, exactly. That was kind of like, I wanted to do something similar, I guess, to like how there was that friendship between the Used and My Chem, and they put in the lyric of a song. And as I mentioned, yeah, we were on tour with All Time Low when I started writing this song, and we had done a couple of tours with them, in fact, by that point. So they were, you know, good buds of ours. And I remember, and this is something that like kind of makes me like cringe now a little bit, but like, FaceTiming one of them and like asking like if it was cool, like, is it cool if we like say All Time Low and one of our, you know, like in one of our songs, and they'd be like, yeah, that's, you know, it's, you know, but it's a little like cringy now to think, oh god, like I can't believe I like called him and asked like, can we, you know, yeah, use your band's name in the song?
Well, we had Alex on the show recently, so I'm going to hit him up and tell him if their next single's not Mayday Parade, I'm going to be pissed, okay? That's the name of their next single, all right?
Nice.
we get into the third and final chorus here, and trying to explain this to the listeners, I'm sure my producer Chris will put in some song snippets here, but, you know, the band are kind of doing these stops on this, like this dun-dun. And we were just kids in love. The summer was full of mistakes. We would only learn from the first kiss. Again, the same lyric, and we were just kids in love. The summer was full of mistakes we wouldn't learn from. The first kiss stole the breath from my lips. Why did the last one tear us? And on that line, the first kiss stole the breath of my lips, the intro drums almost kind of come back. It's like that swing beat. And on the last line, why did the last one tear us? You don't say a part there. What was the thought there? Because it sounds like it could be there.
Right.
Like it wouldn't sound weird being there. Who took that out, and what was the decision behind that?
So originally there was that different lyric. Yeah, whatever it was, something like, we didn't even care. We were just kids. And it went into back into the chorus, you know? And
okay.
So when we changed that, so I feel like it kind of held off better, like suspended, you know, going into that chorus better with the original lyric. And I remember thinking that it sings weird to sing, why did the last one tear us? And like, it is kind of weird, but that was like, you know, we had changed the lyric. That's what it was. And so you're right. Well, it never even crossed our minds, I guess, to put in the apart. It was just, I guess, kind of carried over from the way the song was before, holding out that last line and then firing back into the chorus, because I guess the apart would kind of go over the first line of the restart of the chorus. So yeah, that's one that like was a little weird, but we were just like, well, whatever, I guess. Yeah.
Well, the whole band kind of resolves there on us. It kind of stops for a second and then boom, you're right back in to another chorus. We were just kids in love. The summer was full of mistakes we wouldn't learn from. The first kiss stole the breath from my lips. Why did the last one tear us apart? And then you're doing this kind of a trail off vocal that's mm-hmm. going underneath, which is neat. And then again, it's the same exact lyric that we end the song with. The drums go double time for the last 8 seconds of the song, mm-hmm. and that guitar riff from the bridge comes back, and it's just awesome. That is so cool. And again, you only hear that for 7 seconds in the bridge and the last 8 seconds here. And it's one of my favorite parts of the song. And I'm just the restraint, I think, you had as a songwriter to only use it in those spots, because to me, I would have exploited that riff. I would have had to, because I think it's so strong.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Yeah, well, that's definitely, I think that is one of the best parts of the song. There's that, it kind of, that whole last chorus is building, and then when it's like the full, you know, the drums pick up, like you said,
yeah.
and that riff played like full out for the first time, there's so much energy there, and there's the high vocal being held out of the last note of the chorus. That's definitely, it's like the climax of the song. It's a really cool part for sure. Yeah,
you know, and it sounds like there was a little inner turmoil having to work with outside songwriters. It was something you hadn't done before. You know, you're finally listening to them. You get the mix back of this. What was your thought of it then when it was finally done?
I was stoked on this one for sure. There's definitely songs on the album that I had more mixed feelings about, but this one has always been kind of like, it was sort of obvious, you know. It was like, people are gonna like this one, our fans are gonna like this one, we like this song, even having to deal with, you know, some of the weirdness from the songwriting point and actually tracking it, it still stood out. And, you know, obviously the first song on the album is one that we felt strong about from the very beginning of the process to the end, and it's a song that we still play at like just about almost every show, you know, that we've ever played.
I was going to ask. I always ask that. You pretty much play at every show, and you'd consider it probably one of your fan favorites.
Yeah, it's up there, I'd say, in like the, I don't know, top five or whatever. And so it's one that, yeah, it's become a staple. And, you know, sometimes maybe like if you're playing like a Warped Tour set that's 30 minutes or something where you can only play like 7 songs, maybe it doesn't make it into every... But for the most part, yeah, for the most part, we do it just about every single show, and it's still, you know, it's still so much fun to play. I mean, I'm a big fan of the more energetic songs live in general, just because they're just inherently fun to play those. So this one's up there for sure. Yeah.
Plus your adrenaline's up a couple clicks anyways, you know.
Right.
So yeah. Definitely helps. Well, hey, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to and be on the show today. And is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with that you have going on? I know you said you just recorded a new record.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we just finished recording our 7th full-length album, which is wild. And I don't know, you know, what the next step is of how we're going to roll that all out and everything, but it's cool stuff, man. And we're happy to still be here playing music and making music. We're in an exciting place right now. And Chris, thank you so much for having me here on the show. And I love that you guys are from Gainesville, and I've seen you guys around sometimes. I for some reason, JR is the only, is JR still in the band or?
He's still with us. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
He's still with us.
He's like the only one that like throughout the years that I've like hung with. But he's such a great dude and always so nice. So I hope to see you guys out there again at some point and get a chance to hang.
Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on all your continued success, and I hope to see you sooner than later, my friend.
Right on, Chris. Thank you.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Derp, a 4-piece pop punk rock band from Madison, Wisconsin. Derp consists of Mark Fairchild on the drums, Nikolai Stratman on bass, David Mikulski on lead guitar and backup vocals, and Dan Edgett on lead vocals and rhythm guitar. Here's a snippet of their song, Trembling.
There comes a day when you forget the past, wash it all away.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
All right, man, that was another great episode. I was thinking while you were recording that, and this is going to be the instance in a lot of the episodes because it's just a fact that a lot of songs that exist are love songs. And I'm thinking while you're recording this, how weird it must be for some people not only to have their lyrics read back to them, but when their personal love related lyrics, that might bring an extra level of weirdness for some people.
Well, especially that, you know, it was from his wife. They were high school sweethearts that dated. Her parents didn't like him. They broke up for some time and they got back together. And then, of course, the other component is the fact that, you know, here's this super personal song that, you know, they get bumped up to Atlantic like, hey, we want you to finish this song with somebody else who doesn't know your wife, doesn't know you. Bring them into the fold. And everything he said, I could relate to.
Yeah, I absolutely could relate to that, too, because I've been in that situation myself and my bandmates where it sounds like what he's talking about is kind of trying to force something. It's like, okay, we're going to sit down and do this thing. And it's not like you're necessarily waiting for the inspiration. You're more or less like, okay, let's do this. And it doesn't always work that way.
No, I've co-written with people and it just, after you're sitting there for 2 hours, just kind of staring at each other with blank notepads. And other times it's magic. You just really never know. But I think, you know, being open-minded enough to give it a chance. And that's what he said. You know, he knows that the proof is in the song. When those 10,000 kids are singing every lyric back, they never knew there was a last line of the chorus that was different. You know, they just know what's there.
Yeah, and once again, it was brought up that sort of, he called it cringeworthy lines here and there that you write when you're younger. You know, now when he's talking about this song, for him, this is early in their career, and we've talked about this before. You can relate. I can relate. It's songs that people still like today by your band that you look back and you're like, oh man, that's not very good. But to the people listening, that song could have deep personal meaning to them. And just because you feel like you've come a long way as a lyric writer or a songwriter doesn't make that song mean any less to that person listening.
Yeah, you know, and Derek had mentioned he doesn't, you know, oh man, I should have listened to the demo. I mean, we don't sit around as artists in general and listen to our music. You know, once it's recorded, listen to the mixes, maybe if you hear it on the radio or, you know, when you walk into a venue, if they're playing your song, but it's not like we sit around and listen to ourselves. And definitely don't sit around and listen to my demos. I can't tell you the last time I said, you know, I'm going to go check out what the Losing Streak demos sounded like.
Dude, I will say that I will listen to my own band's music in that period between when you record it and when it comes out. That's the safe zone where it's cool to listen to your own music.
Oh, for sure. And for anybody getting any ideas, I'm not putting the Losing Streak demos up on the Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. All right. Thank you.
Oh, man. People would lose their minds. I liked when Derek talked about how they recorded an alternate version without mentioning cigarettes and alcohol in case it got played on Radio Disney or something. The Cheetos and Marshmallows version or whatever it was. I've never done an alternate censored version of a song. I guess I've never been in that situation. Have you had to do that?
Yeah,
before?
We did. And we did it for, it wasn't because the lyrics couldn't get on the radio. It was for this song Overrated we had. We did an alternate version just because I think My Chemical Romance did an alternate version of one song just for fun. And the idea at Warner Brothers at the time was, you know, you want to throw it out there and shock people and go, wait a second, well, that's a different version. And your friend going, no, what are you talking about? That's the same song. No, it's not. And kind of get chatter going. And this was, you know, mid-2000s when, you know, new things on the internet were happening. And, you know, just so I think it was just some kind of marketing ploy and tool. But a lot of times labels will do it because there's profanity or something they feel is too risque to get like on Disney or something that Derek was talking about.
Yeah, I think about the time in the 90s when albums were released on both cassette and CD. And the one example I can think of is past guest Fat Mike NoFX on the album Punk and Drublic. Did you know that on, I guess, the CD version, the part where it goes, hell, he's even more punk than me, uh-huh, is different on the cassette than on the CD. It's a different voice. It's a different, like, Hefe voice or whatever's in there. Did you know that?
I never knew that. No, I didn't have the cassette. I think I only had the CD. That would be why.
You guys are always on the cutting edge of doing stuff like that, too. I mean, the only band I ever knew who put the hidden track before the first song. So, you know, I figured that would have been something you guys did in that period of time between the cassette and the CD.
No, we never did that one. Now you want me to make search out the cassette version of Punk and Drublic and check that out.
Dude, yeah, it's true. You'll see. The one other thing that I thought was funny, once again, Derek said it in sort of a cringy way, but I was like, I don't really think that's cringy. I think that's cool, was when he talked about using the term all-time low, which at that, just because you're saying all-time low doesn't mean you're necessarily referencing the band, but he was talking about how they made that reference in their song. And I know that you're no stranger to referencing, well, you reference a lot of people in your songs, whether it's Friends or Jay Frenzel or whoever. Have you referenced any bands in your songs? You had to.
Not that I... yes. In a song called Three Quarts Drunk, there was an old punk band called The Digits that we talk about there. Spinning around, yeah. As I'm trying to find a place to take a stand, but only wind up sitting any place I can.
With a Digits song stuck in my head, I gotta think out. I always think that's awesome when bands reference other bands or cite a lyric of another band. I think that's cool. I'm sure the Punchline's done it a lot, and I'm just not thinking of what it is off the top of my head. But that being said, I think it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, the line was, with a Digits song stuck in my head. That was the lyric in Three Quarts Drunk from Pezcore. So, yeah, Digits, nice. Old punk rock band. Any band that was really popular that people would know in mass, I can't think if we did.
The one other thing that you guys talked about in this episode was the concept of copy and pasting, whether it's vocals or just an entire part of a song. That's an easy thing to do nowadays. Maybe it wasn't as easy back in the day, but now that's so easy to do. Like, just do a couple crossfades in Logic or Pro Tools or whatever, and boom, you've spliced in the same exact part. And I think you and I would both agree that it's cool to actually play it and not just copy and paste and drop in.
Yeah, sometimes it works. You know, I agree with Derek. Sometimes a chorus should be the same. You want it to feel the same. You want it to hit you over the head. But it's those little nuances that make that music are supposed to have, those happy mistakes. And I think that you shouldn't copy and paste everything. And I tried to explain it in layman's terms earlier for some of the listeners that don't know. It's no different than on your computer. You want to copy some text, and then you want to paste it over here into another email. That's basically what you're doing in a recording program. You're copying this vocal here, and you're pasting it where it's going to be later in the song. And technically, it's cheating, and I cheat a lot.
Well, I mean, sometimes, yeah, you don't want to trick the listener or something. You want people to be able to sing along, but subtle differences can make it interesting. So maybe you're singing the same melody, but there's differences in the guitars, there's differences in the way that the production of that part. I think those subtle differences, maybe that you don't even hear when you're listening, take it to the next level, bring that part, give that part life, and not just have it be a flat thing. I think that's a something you've touched on a lot in these episodes.
Yeah, and the last thing I do want to say is, and I was just amazed when I was thinking about it, because I remember when they first came on the scene, is how long they've been a band. They've been a band for 16 years now, Mayday Parade. And bands years ago didn't have a shelf life of 16 years. And I really attribute that to things such as social media, the Warped Tour, giving you that audience, and then it's up to you as a band to maintain it. But there's more and more bands bands that are having longevity, you know, and having a career in this than there ever was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's really interesting. And like I said, I couldn't believe that they were 16 years old, though they still seem like little kids to me.
Everybody seems like little kids to you, man. every half the bands. Yeah, we've all been doing this for a while now, and it's cool that bands and artists can have longevity. You have outlets for your music a lot of times. You know, a lot of people, regardless of the financial aspect of it, or if you're willing to tour, you always have that outlet. Whether 5 people are listening to your music, 100 people, or thousands of people are listening to it, you have an outlet. You have, you know, all the places people can stream music now. And I just think that there's a lot of people out there that are doing it for the love of creating music. And I think that's a great thing, man.
It is a great thing. And another great thing, Chris, is our monthly fundraiser over at KristaMakesADifference.com.
It most definitely is, as are all our listeners who contribute to the great causes at KristaMakesADifference.com each month. And we can't thank everyone enough for that.
And I have to echo those sentiments. Absolutely. Our fundraiser for May is the Cure LGMD2I Foundation. Limb-girdle muscular dystrophy type 2I is a progressively debilitating disease. The foundation provides funding for research programs to establish a treatment for this disease. So head over to KristaMakesADifference.com. Whatever you can contribute is greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for your generosity.
This is an awesome fundraiser, and if you're listening to this episode the day it comes out, this is actually the last day for it. So if you can, contribute $1, contribute $5, $10, $20, whatever you can afford over at KristaMakesADifference.com, and it'll go towards research for a cure to a rare and debilitating disease.
That's right. And I know we've been talking about this a lot lately, so bear with us if you've heard it a bunch, but we're just really excited about our VIP program. It's called Supporting Cast, where Chris and I bring you the after party, which is episodes outside of the podcast, extra content for you, because a lot of people have said that 1 hour episode of Krista Makes a Podcast a week just isn't enough, Chris.
Nowhere near enough. I mean, there's probably people out there that want an episode every single day, and maybe we'll get there. Maybe we will just do nothing with our lives but make podcasts nonstop eventually. It just depends on what the people want. For now, we're going to do our weekly episode of Krista Makes a Podcast, and we're going to put out an episode of The After Party, and we'll see where you all who listen direct us and guide us. One place you can tell us is in the Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. If you don't use Facebook, then we'll have to find another way. But, you know, for now, that's a great place to hit us up.
I always tell people to make a burner account. Just make a fake account and join.
Yeah, you know. Sure. Why not?
Head over to KristaMakes.com for all the information for supporting Cast and how you can help us stay afloat. Chris has said before, for the price of buying each of us a beer or a couple cups of coffee or something, you can really help us sustain and keep this thing going and growing to the future.
Hell yeah, man.
I want to thank this week's guest, Mr. Derek Sanders from Mayday Parade, for sitting in the hot seat with us, and we'll see you next week.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.